I'm Christopher Lydon, laying down some of my own How Did We Become an Empire obsessions before a real authority, the celebrated young historian Maya Jazanoff, who teaches the British Empire course at Harvard. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. The obsession, or the question, Maya Jazanoff, is roughly this. How did we Americans, with anti-imperialism in our revolutionary history, in our DNA, so to speak, how did we let ourselves in for the burdens and the sorrows of empire, the cost of empire, the disrepute of empire? And what is our chance of escaping the fate of empires? You teach the British Empire course, but I'm sure your students ask you now and then, where are we Americans in this age of Obama? Three wars abroad and a lot of distress at home. Where are we in the timeline of that British story?
So I think here in America, we inherited a lot more of the British attitude at the time of our founding and have carried it all the way through than a lot of us maybe think we have. And now we find ourselves having picked up the mantle of the British Empire in many ways, looking at the British experience for better and worse.
At which parts? Global self-consciousness, yes. Bullying, domination, I wonder.
We've inherited places, problems, and approaches from the British. And we find ourselves fighting wars in places the British were in. We find ourselves spreading kinds of rhetoric and values that the British were interested in. And we find ourselves expressing international power through cultural means and through investment in ways that the British did. I think now, though, about a decade ago, I think Americans got interested in the history of the British Empire because they saw themselves as being in the position, perhaps, of Britain in 1880, 90, or 1900, sort of at the peak of their confidence and global hegemony. Now, just a decade later, we find ourselves looking at that British experience and thinking about whether we are in the position of the British Empire in 1930, 1940, or 1950, when we're overstretched and things seem to be hard to sustain.
So many interesting points there. I mean, was Vietnam the Boer War a kind of warning, or was Iraq the Boer War after all? A warning that, no, that was one war too far.
I think it's hard to draw specific analogies between specific conflicts, and I think we abuse history somewhat when we think that it repeats itself so much as that history is on a continuum, I think, is maybe a better way to look at it. The problems, however, that Britain faced in the Boer War and at the turn of the 20th century were certainly problems that indicated something of its overstretch. And to that extent, perhaps the best analogy for us has been the situation in Iraq, where we find ourselves dealing, of course, with Afghanistan on the one hand, with Iraq on the other. Now we find ourselves involved in Libya. So you could look at Iraq as a bit of a turning point for us, I suppose, in terms of exposing the limits of our global capacity.
Maya Jazanoff, you write wonderfully detailed histories like this book I have to admire, Liberty's Exiles, about a great variety of family stories of British loyalists after the decisive American triumph in independence in 1783. They went all over the place. It turned out, in fact, to be a time of expansion of their fortunes. How do you position yourself between my own polar views of the British Empire? I mean, there's the Neil Ferguson view that it was the gift of the language of Shakespeare and Milton and law and banking and civilization more than anything else. And there's also the David Reif view, expressed to me informally one time, that it was the worst war crime in the history of the species. I mean, roughly, where is Maya Jazanoff on that continuum?
So I teach a course on the British Empire, and my students are always interested in the question of whether I think the British Empire was a good thing or a bad thing, and I spend a semester avoiding that question. The reason being that I don't think that it's a very analytically useful question for the historian or for the citizen of the world today. I think it's far too blunt-edged to be meaningful, and I think to come up with a sweeping judgment about the British Empire would be analogous to coming up with a sweeping judgment about modernity or about democracy in the modern world. So my position is that we have to think about the British Empire as a historical fact, along with other empires. We need to remember that empire is the oldest form of government in world history. It's always been with us. It continues to be with us under different names. And that the key question about the British Empire is to look at the pros and the cons, for whom it was good, for whom it was bad, under what circumstances were the better parts manifested.
I hope your students don't let you get away with that.
Well,
I mean, the question has to be asked, particularly because the public relations of the British Empire, the movies, the language, the literature, the cover-up, the continuing sort of merchant ivory polishing of that role, it's so seductive. And you want to say, stop, no. They were burning people to death in the ground in Kenya. All these horror stories that Neil Ferguson simply doesn't want to believe.
I agree. I certainly am not in the business of not showing them the violence and the bloody sides and the exploitation, which is very much economic as well as violent, as you've just outlined. And in fact, in my summary lecture for the class, one of the things that I point to is the way in which the majority of former British colonies are part of the Third World today. The majority of former British colonies have not had anything like democratic government in the post-colonial era. And we need to look to the imperial heritage to explain that in part. We cannot simply say, I'm certainly not in the business of saying the British Empire was a good thing. But I also think very firmly that simply to put a label, as Ferguson might saying good, or as critics might say saying bad, is not getting us very far in trying to understand what really happened.
What did happen?
I think what happened is something that we in America really need to think about hard, which is that there were actors involved in imperial government who were invested in trying to implement forms of rule that they thought were actually kind of good. They thought that it was basically kind of good to have, for example, trial by jury. That's one of the great, you know, pillars of
yes.
British law, right? I think that often in history and often in the present, there are people who believe that they're trying to do the right thing, and that often they find that they run up into the wrong thing along the way.
Right.
And that's something we need to study. But I think that if we lose out the parts of the story that are favoring outcomes or favoring approaches that we may find sympathetic, then we miss the message. And the message is, how can we best promote these approaches and these outcomes that we want and make sure we reach those points without getting terribly diverged into war and violence and exploitation along the way.
How do you instruct kids in penetrating the public relations of the empire? I remember seeing a T-shirt for sale in Singapore at a store called the British Raj, and the inscription on the T-shirt was, "A time of exploitation and oppression and great outfits." The outfits are still what we remember.
I think you have to think about when and how they made it seem that way. I think you're quite right to point to the merchant ivory picture. No doubt that that presents a very sort of glossy and attractive picture of an imperial reality that was much worse. However, the merchant ivory picture of the empire was a picture that was created in the ones you're talking about were really created in the 1980s. Which was a time when Thatcher was governing in Britain, and when there was a great sort of groundswell of interest in imperial nostalgia. I think if you look at the representations of empire throughout the period when the empire was there, you'll find a much more ambivalent set of representations. You will always find a critical voice running all the way from Edmund Burke up through J.A. Hobson at the turn of the 20th century.
Amen. This is an important point. There's an anti-imperial tradition in Britain. How do you teach them?
I include them. I mean, it's one thing to not want to come down on a black and white spectrum of good or bad on the British Empire. It's another thing to promote a one-sided vision of the British imperial past, and that's certainly not something that I try to do. I think that if you bring in the voices of the critics all the way through, then you give students a feel for the kinds of complexities and debates and anxieties and inconsistencies that come up along the way when you are a global hegemon. And that's why I think it is fundamentally irresponsible to teach the history of the British Empire as a matter of black and white, when we in America today are dealing with the reality, whether we like it or not, of living in the world as a world hegemon. And the key is, again, in my mind, how do you exercise your privilege, your responsibility, as some would see it, in the best possible way? And I think that simply condemning it condemns us to a false isolationist position that is in no way representative of the reality of the world in which we live.
I'm so glad you mentioned Edmund Burke, a great hero of mine, but the question obsessively on my mind is, where is the Edmund Burke in the American world in the 21st century? Burke would go down as an imperialist, but he gave the best years, the longest speech, a four-day speech for the impeachment of Warren Hastings in the cause of denouncing imperial injustice, predatory rule. He is the conscience of imperial justice and a universal citizenship and deepest respect for the Indians that Hastings and the East India Company had taken charge of. But I keep wondering, where is that restraint in our world?
I think Burke is a fascinating figure for us to think about now, because Burke, when it came to empire, didn't believe that empire was wrong. Again, Burke lived in a world in which empires were the dominant form of government. We live in a world in which empire isn't the word that we use, but in which global power is exercised by a few nations. We can't avoid that. Burke didn't think that empire per se was bad, but Burke was committed to the idea that imperial rule should be performed in a responsible, law-abiding way. Burke really stands out as an example of the kind of thing that I would advocate for, which is to say that accepting that empire is there, accepting that global hegemony is there, accepting even that you think that your way of doing things might be better than their way of doing things, how then do you achieve your goals in a responsible way?
You mentioned a fascinating point that we're sort of discovering ourselves as the inheritors of those British interests. Egypt, to take a very specific example. But to me, it's still a shocking discovery that we Americans inherited so much of that power, and we kidded ourselves that it was somehow their regime now.
The experience of the British Empire, obviously, and the French Empire, I should say, and the Dutch Empire, and indeed in its way, the Soviet Empire, gave empire a bad name, which means that we don't like to use the word, which means that in the world today we have on the order of 170 nation states, and we have only one person in the world who's called an emperor. That's the Emperor of Japan, and Japan is a democracy. So the word empire has gone out of fashion. There's no doubt about that. But you're quite right. I mean, we live in a world in which there are still, if you will, imperial mechanisms in place. These, because they don't involve formal territorial occupation so much, and because they don't involve so much direct government by, for example, Americans in overseas places, we don't classify it as formal empire. But the things that we're up to are easily classified, I think, under the heading of informal empire, something that Britain exerted as well beyond the boundaries of its formal empire in the 19th century world. And I think that we ignore that reality at our peril. I mean, I think that we, as you say, we sort of dress up our position in the world as being that of a, you know, liberty-loving democracy, and all we're doing is supporting liberty-loving democracies around the world, when in fact we are exerting a kind of informal imperial presence.
You have family roots in India, going back to the Raj, the British Raj, I'm sure, right?
They must have done, since it goes back probably many millennia.
How did that color your ambition as a historian, or even your view of the matter?
I think for me, coming from, I'm half Indian and I'm half Eastern European Jewish. So I think my own picture on the world is fundamentally colored by coming from two different traditions and realizing that, you know, it's not one or the other, it's both, you know. And so I, of course, heard stories from my grandparents about the independence struggle and the sanctity of Gandhi and all the rest of it. I grew up with that kind of thing. But I also grew up attuned, I guess, to the ways in which cultures come together unexpectedly, the ways in which there are vestiges of, say, Britain embedded in a proudly post-colonial India, the fact that my family, you know, was very well educated and Anglophone and wedded to certain kinds of British literary culture alongside, again, being very proudly nationalist and proud of, you know, India's achievements.
Coach me, coach us Americans on dealing with these complexities here. As you say, you remind me of C.L.R. James, the Trinidadian writer who adored cricket and Thackeray and Dickens in the sort of pre-Victorian England, but he recoiled at empire. He was one of the early, most articulate black nationalists in the 1930s. That's a combination, I mean, that we love. But how do Americans sort of cope with this double reality of being hegemonic and just praying that we don't end up as monsters?
The fundamental difference between America now and Britain then is that America is an incredibly diverse and multi-ethnic society. And I think it's our great national achievement is that we actually have attained a degree of multi-ethnic citizenship in this country for all its obvious problems and for all the obvious discomforts of that. We have actually achieved a kind of plural and multi-ethnic society in a way that very few other places in the world have. But what that means is that on the one hand, obviously, we see groups of people in America who are very hostile to difference next door or abroad. On the plus side, it means that we can encounter difference by going to another neighborhood of the cities in which we live. And so I also think it would be very helpful if, in place of the sense that neighbors who don't look like you are a threat, we can do all we can to cultivate the idea that neighbors who don't look like you are also part of your society.
Take off other major differences you see between the British Empire as a company, as a system, and ours.
I think the divergence between rhetoric and reality is much greater for us now. And I think that what we've really forgotten here is that being a Republican nation state is not incompatible with being an empire. That in the era of our founding, being an empire was what America aspired to. Jefferson envisioned an empire of liberty, as he saw it, as being America's role on the continent and beyond. And that now we tend to dupe ourselves by saying, oh, well, you know, we're a great democracy, we're a great republic, you know, we're promoting that around the world, when plainly our own democracy is very much in trouble and plainly our role in the world is not quite as benign as we like to think. And in Britain, you know, again, there were always the critics, there were always the people challenging it. Of course, there were always also the people lauding imperial intervention. But I don't think anyone would be in disagreement about the fact that Britain was an empire, that Britain was involved around the world in these ways, that this was central to what being British was about. And I think that there's a kind of honesty in that, for all its bleakness, if you don't like the idea of empire, I think you have to applaud the kind of honesty that goes into saying this is who we are and this is what we're doing. And it allows for a degree of public debate and engagement with what it means to be an empire that we're really lacking in America right now.
Right. How do Americans get real about the very sorry fate of empires? And is there anything to be done about, you know, the decline and fall? I mean, that's what they do in the end, empires.
They do, yeah. And I think the challenge for us is whether it can happen in a relatively less painful way for them and for us. You know, clearly we're living in a moment right now where our budgets are our economy is not doing well. We're involved overseas on too many fronts. We can't sustain this relationship. Meanwhile, you know, there's this paranoia about China catching up, which reminds me quite a bit of the way the British panicked about Germany catching up around 1900. We're in a time of global flux. It's very like the world around 1900, I think, in as much as the sort of old established power centers are still very much there, still very much on the world scene and directing global affairs, but in which there are sort of new things coming up, in which there are also the feeling that there is sort of unsettling new technologies and unsettling new ideologies and unsettling movements of people around the world, that sort of thing. It reminds me very much of the world about a century ago. And so the key question that I have is whether we can avoid what happened to the world around 1900, which was that it then slid into World War I and all of the chaos and mayhem that followed. And hopefully we will find ourselves in a situation where we don't end up in such a global conflagration.
How would we put ourselves in the situation to avoid this clash of empires, East and West?
Well, if I knew the answer to that, then I would be running for president.
I was going to say.
I think, I mean, going gracefully is always a good thing. I don't know. I think we need to return in America to remembering what it is that we care about and finding ways to express that that have an impact. And I think one of the problems, of course, of the Bush era was that the message of democracy became a message that was so tarnished in the eyes of the people who received it, as well as in the eyes of the American left, that we lost sight of its values. I think, you know, in the way that America is sizing itself up against China right now, there's a lot of rhetoric about how, well, oh, China has all these human rights violations, and, you know, China doesn't have free speech, and China's not a democracy, and look, we do. The problem is that for people like me who are on the left and who believe in these things, we're such cynics now in America that we don't think that we ourselves represent those values effectively on the world stage. I don't think we do represent them effectively on the world stage, but that's not to say that those values are things that are bad, and it's not to say that those values are not things that we can actually try to recover. And so this, again, is where my difficulty with the good and bad judgments comes out, because I think there are good things that we can stand for. And I think that if we let our cynicism and our pessimism about them overtake or overcome, you know, our vision of the world, then we're just letting ourselves fall apart and not really doing anything effective to stop it. I don't know what the most effective ways are to stop it, but I can only believe that it's going to reside in returning to those ideas that, you know what, we can actually stand up for human rights, we can stand up for free speech, we can stand up for a type of international engagement that is committed to the good things in development as opposed to being a mask for economic exploitation.
Maya Jasanoff, you cover a whole lot of ground, and thank you for doing it with us. Thank you for your book, Liberty's Exiles, and thank you for this conversation.
It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.